NPR is preparing to celebrate its 40th anniversary. To kick things off, the network today released the long-awaited complete compendium of its fundraising announcements. The box set spans the entire history of NPR programming. Critic Tom Moon has this review.
This year, at the Public Media Underwriting Association competition, NPR took top honors for on-air sponsorship announcements. After winning the coveted Fundy Award, NPR's top brass decided to finally give in to public demand and make these radio gems available. The result is a comprehensive 20-CD collection that's like nothing else on the market.
Support for NPR comes from the Council for Core Values and the Corporation for Living Legacies, and from the Spearmint Association, promoting flavors when flavors are needed.
You might think that as a loyal listener, you've heard all of NPR's funding credits. You would be wrong. The collection includes an entire disc of rarities and outtakes.
Support for NPR comes from A La Neutrale, encouraging apolitical thinking on public policy through indifference. Hammer World. Excuse me, let me restrain myself. Hammer World, makers of humane tools for the home.
At long last, connoisseurs of these tastefully discreet acknowledgments can hear them as they were originally intended. They've been remastered in high-definition 27-bit audio.
Lasercast, makers of political think tanks for home or office.
That Lasercast. Voice, of course, is the legendary Arthur DeFacante. He's been reading the underwriting credits since May 3, 1971, when All Things Considered first went on the air.
NPR programs are supported by the new movie, Me and You and a Dog Named Boo. By Kewful and Esser, makers of quality slide rules, helping today's students to become tomorrow's scientists.
Hearing these fleeting announcements, what you realize is that there's a true art to them. The inflections are just so, the timing utterly perfect. When necessary, DeFacante achieves a tone of Cronkitean severity. More often, he's the essence of a gentle soul, calling out the civic works of an agricultural conglomerate in soothing, comforting tones.
Support for NPR comes from Orion and Armstrong Seeds and Seedlings, planting ideas and artichokes. We bring the world to your plate.
The set represents a massive amount of work. Nothing in recent memory, not the Neil Young Archives Project or the 31-disc set of Daniel Shore commentaries, the Dutch years, 1940 to 1953, comes close. But this isn't merely entertainment. The Funding Announcements Collection serves as an almost complete oral history of corporate America.
NPR programs are supported by Bernard L. Madoff Investment Securities, LLC, watching over your investments so you don't have to. And the Tourism Bureau of the German Democratic Republic. Come see us and stay a while.
The box set isn't perfect, of course. There's inevitably some repetition over the years. But hang in there. Because when you pay attention without the pesky distractions of the news and commentaries, you begin to appreciate these bits as the very bedrock of public radio. They slip past our consciousness, almost unnoticed, but they're always there, in the background, an ethereal, almost magical presence, connecting us to the true spirit of the endeavor.
That's critic Tom Moon. The CD boxed set is The Collected Underwriting Credits of NPR, Volumes 1 through 20. To hear and see Arthur DeFacante perform, go to our website, npr.org. After yesterday's White House announcement on offshore drilling, we wondered, who gets the money from offshore leases, the federal government or the states? Well, so for the answer to that and other questions, we've called upon law professor John Lowe of Southern Methodist University. He's the author of Oil and Gas Law in a Nutshell. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
And tell me first, if a company bids on a lease to drill offshore and gets the lease, to whom does he pay his rent?
Well, it depends where that lease is located. We have a fairly complicated structure of federal statutes that basically gives most of the states the right to income from leases within 3 nautical miles of the edge of their land. Mm-hmm. And then gives them a share of the lease revenues that go to the federal government. 27.5% of the revenues that go to the federal government come back to the states for leases that are within another 3 nautical miles from the edge of the 3 nautical mile limit from the shoreline. And then the Gulf Coast states, after Rita and Katrina, cut a special deal, and they get 50% of the Outer Continental Shelf royalties.
So this is a rich and varied answer to this question as to how much do the states get?
That's correct. It depends where the leases are located and which states are involved. And it's a lot of money. In fiscal year 2006, there were nearly $8 billion of bonuses and royalties generated to the federal government.
But, Professor Lowe, you're talking about some distances of 3 nautical miles and another 3 nautical miles and then some more miles. Yesterday's announcement involved drilling 50 miles or more off the Virginia coast and 125 miles or more off the Florida coast. First of all, say 125 miles off the Florida coast. Is that actually U.S. sovereign water out there, 125 miles offshore?
It's what we call the exclusive economic zone out to 200 miles. The president's announcement was structured to try to minimize conflict with state jurisdiction.
And out there, does the state still have a claim to revenue from the leases that are struck so distant from the shore?
At the moment, no. If we are talking about leases off of the eastern seaboard of the United States, but I think we can anticipate that the Congress people and the senators are going to line up and claim the same sorts of revenue sharing that has been given since 2006 to Alabama, Texas, Mississippi, and Louisiana.
So the principle here is the revenue goes first to the federal government, and then whatever the states can get out of the federal government through Congress, they can get.
I think that's a fair assessment, and the greater number of states off which oil and gas development is taking place, the larger is the potential group of congresspeople and senators who are going to line up to support that kind of legislation.
Once the government determines what area will be put up for bid, how large do you imagine a typical lease would be for? How much seabed?
Well, typically, offshore leases are 5,760 acres. It's done on a block basis. And they have a primary term, meaning a period during which the industry can think about drilling and prepare to drill of 5 to 10 years. This is a long and complicated process. We are not likely to see any additional drilling activity taking place, certainly not for a year and probably for 2 or 3 years.
Well, Professor Lowe, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thank you, Robert. It's a pleasure.
That's John Lowe, law professor at Southern Methodist University. He has written, among other books, Oil and Gas Law in a Nutshell.
Writer Ian McEwan's latest literary effort had an icy beginning. He joined a group of artists and scientists on a week-long trip to the Arctic, sponsored by a British-based project called Cape Farewell. The idea was to inspire painters, photographers, sculptors, authors, even dancers, to think about climate change. And it was a small insight McEwan had during that voyage that led him to write his latest novel, Solar. As NPR's Lynn Neary reports, it's an irreverent take on a serious issue.
The first thing you notice about the Arctic, says Ian McEwan, is the cold. Once you get past that, you're ready to take in the landscape, which is like no other. In a BBC documentary about the Cape Farewell journey, McEwan spoke about the striking beauty of the frozen north.
Extraordinary formations of sedimentary rock around the fjord in this curious sort of egg and dart shape. Simple things like the music of ice and snow under your boots.
But McEwen was struck by something else during his week aboard the ship, that even the best of intentions can go awry in the hands of human beings. Over dinner one night, he told his shipmates that the chaos that had overtaken the room where all their gear was stored seemed a perfect metaphor for human frailty.
All it needs is one mistake, and then there's a domino effect. Someone saying, well, damn it, you know, I'll take those boots because someone took my boots. And you actually have a social contract in total collapse. The boot room now is just a scene of total lack of cooperation. And, you know, environmentalists who care about the planet can't even get their boots together.
Before going to the Arctic, McEwen had been interested in the issue of climate change, but couldn't figure out a way to write a novel about it without sounding too preachy. Something about the disarray in the ship's boot room gave him an idea.
And it seemed to strike a chord with a lot else that I understood about climate science, the politics of it, and human institutions, that we're very good at making wide and sweeping statements of intent. But once we get down to it, often very little happens. And that was at least it gave me the first suspicion that maybe the route into this was through comedy, a comedy of human nature.
That boot room scene eventually made its way into McEwen's new novel, Solar. His main character, Michael Beard, takes a similar journey to the Arctic. Beard doesn't really care that much about climate change. He just wants to get away from the chaos of his own life. He falls under the spell of the Arctic and his amiable companions, but he finds that messy boot room irritating.
That morning, he saw several snowmobile suits also on the floor. They had a trampled appearance, and he decided, without looking too closely, that none could be his. Pickett admitted to him, while they were out recording the sound of the wind in the ship's rigging, that for 2 days he had been wearing 2 left boots. But he was a hardy sort who did not seem to mind. Beard did mind.
Beard is invited on the Arctic journey because he's a Nobel Prize-winning physicist. McEwen says he knew he had to write about a Nobel winner after being introduced to some of these scientific giants at a conference.
And I've never been in a room bristling with such powerful egos. I mean, these guys are grand. And it was at that point I thought, if I ever get round to writing a novel about climate science, I definitely have to award a Nobel Prize to my principal character.
Michael Beard may have the towering ego of a Nobel Prize-winning scientist, but he is also deeply flawed. A womanizer who has cheated on all of his many wives, he eats too much, drinks too much, and has virtually no moral compass. As for his scientific accomplishments, he lives off the laurels of his past glory. His foray into the science of climate change is spurred on by a bizarre accident that offers him an opening to steal someone else's ideas. Beard, says McEwen, represents all of us at our worst.
He's somewhat lazy, rather greedy, full of resolutions to give up eating junk food and lose weight and get fit. Sort of believes in climate change, but skeptically can't be bothered to get too interested in it until an opportunity presents itself. And then he sees a chance to both save the world, make his name, and to make some money.
McEwen says this farcical portrayal of a scientist loaded down with bad habits is his way of depicting how difficult it is for spoiled, lazy, self-centered human beings to take on the challenges required to reverse the effects of climate change. And despite, or maybe even because of his many flaws, Beard was a fun character to create.
It's interesting to have such a wildly erroneous guy at the center of things. I could get him to say and do things that maybe I wouldn't if I was trying to make a climate science novel and have a paragon of virtue at its center, which I think would be awfully dull. But it meant I could have a side swipe at a few other things along the way, like the British press. It gave me a sort of freedom to just lash out a bit.
McEwen is probably best known for his novel Atonement, which was set mostly in the past. But Solar and his recent novel Saturday both take place in the present and explore the anxieties of our post-9/11 world.
The present is always very noisy and contentious, and we all have a very different view of the present and a slightly more coherent and generally more sort of settled view of the past. So when you write about the present and in the present, you get your hands a little more dirty and you find that people disagree with your take on the present and It's much more lively.
McEwan says he has no idea whether his next book will be set in the past, the present, or the future, nor does he know what it will be about. And that, he says, is part of the pleasure of being a novelist, never knowing what will inspire you next. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
Read a bit more of Michael Beard's adventures in the Arctic and a review of Ian McEwan's new novel, Solar, at our website, npr.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. We're produced by Nicole Beemsterboer, Tracy Wall, and Cara Tallo. Senior producers include Cindy Carpian, Barry Gordimer, Neva Grant, Tom Bullock, and Jim Wildman. Our executive producer is Madalika Sicca.
Morning Edition's theme music was written by B.J. Lederman and arranged by Jim Pugh. If you want to send us a tweet, you can reach us at Morning Edition. And a special thank you to you, Mary Louise, for being with us all this week. It's been really fun.
It has been really fun. So you're welcome. It's been great fun keeping Steve's chair warm all week here. Steve Inskeep will be back next week. Have a great weekend. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Renee Montaigne.
The new health care law expands more than just medical care. It also creates the first ever federal insurance plan to help Americans with long-term care needs pay for them. NPR's Julie Rovner reports.
Most people don't realize how expensive long-term care is until they need it, and most people will need it.
We find that, you know, the vast majority of people need long-term care assistance as they get older, but they don't save for it.
Nora Super is head of federal relations for the senior group AARP. She says most people don't realize until it's too late that they're not covered for things like the everyday help people need as they age, things like dressing, bathing, and eating and preparing meals.
Medicare does not cover any long-term care needs. Now, Medicaid does, but only for people that spend down or, in other words, don't have the resources to cover their nursing home needs or their long-term care needs.
Which brings us to the new law known as the Class Act. It was one of the last legislative efforts of the late Senator Edward Kennedy. Judy Fetter is a longtime expert on long-term care. She says the measure is a major achievement.
The Class Act is a phenomenal change in the landscape on long-term care because it establishes a federal long-term care insurance program.
Fetter, a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and professor at Georgetown University, explains how the new law would work.
The concept is that people start paying in when they're working, and after they've contributed for a period of 5 years, they become eligible for a benefit should they become impaired and need help.
And the program isn't just for the elderly, she says, but for anyone of any age who could become disabled.
Bad things happen to anybody. I'm sure we all have friends or know of cases where a family has a disabled child, a pregnancy has difficulties, or a teenager has a diving accident.
So say you do sign up and end up needing long-term care. What do you get? Well, the benefit, estimated at about $50 to $75 a day, won't go far for those who need nursing home care. That can cost more than $75,000 a year. But Al Schmitz, a principal with the healthcare consulting firm Milliman, says for those trying to avoid a nursing home, it can make a real difference.
You know, $50 a day, somebody getting $1,500 a month, that can still, you know, help with getting some home care, getting people some community assistance. That really provides, it's still a significant benefit in my mind.
And how will you sign up? Well, the program is voluntary, but if your employer decides to offer it, you'll be automatically enrolled unless you opt out. Schmitz agrees that's a good way to get people to participate, but he's worried about something else.
The concern is whether they're going to be able to attract employers to get them to offer this plan.
Employers might not want to take on the paperwork hassle. Schmitz says that leads him to another worry, whether the premiums and benefits will match up. Under the law, the new program has to raise enough money in premiums to cover all the benefits. It will be up to the Department of Health and Human Services to set those final levels.
If the final premiums that are determined end up being too high, that has the potential to, you know, scare away healthy individuals and really only attract those who are less healthy.
In other words, those most likely to need the care, which wouldn't create a large enough pool of healthy people to cover the benefits. But Judy Fetter said she's confident that won't happen. She says the Congressional Budget Office estimated that the program would pay for itself over the next 75 years, and it based that estimate on participation rates for private long-term care insurance, which only enrolls about 5% of the population.
And I think that that's conservative because with a federally blessed, federally advertised program, there is a likelihood of higher participation rates from the get-go, which is what you need to make sure that healthy people are signing up.
But Schmidt says maybe the most important thing about the new long-term care law is merely its existence. When it launches next year, he says, it should get more Americans thinking about their future long-term care needs. Julie Rovner, NPR News, Washington.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
I'm Robert Siegel, and now it's time for a puzzle. In this case, a planetary puzzle. From NPR science correspondent Robert Krolwich.
Maybe the first science thing you learn when you're a kid is that the sun is surrounded by planets, and you learn their order.
Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars.
And then you learn there's a pattern. First you get the rocky planets close to the sun, and then the normal progression is after rocky, 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 you get gassy, 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 gassy.
And then icy, 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 icy at the end of that. But when you say normal...
What I mean by normal, I told Caltech astronomy professor Mike Brown, is it's, you know, like our solar system.
Exactly. Yeah. So normal, this is if you had talked to me 20 years ago, mm-hmm. I would have said, yes, not only is our planet, our solar system that way, but that's the way... all planetary systems that we find are going to be, and we understand why.
Because 20 years ago, we thought there were rules about building solar systems, rules we understood that you could, you know, learn, say, in science films at school. We knew that our solar system began with a cloud.
There's this cloud of gas and dust in space.
And in that dust, you'd find hydrogen and oxygen.
H2O, water.
Yeah, and because of gravity, all that water vapor and dust would kind of clump.
So gravity is pulling everything together and pulling everything together.
Creating in the hot zone near the sun, first the rocky planets.
Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars. But as you get out to about where Jupiter is, there's a place that's called, by astronomers, it's called the ice line.
And because the ice line was some distance from the sun, it's kind of cold out there.
At the ice line, it gets to be below the freezing point of water. So all of that gaseous water that's circling the star freezes.
And produces an orbiting snowball. Actually, it's more like an ice ball that as it gets bigger pulls in more and more water vapor.
So you can start to get big.
And the bigger it gets, the stronger its gravitational pull.
And makes it go suddenly from being 15 times bigger than the Earth to 300 times bigger than the Earth.
Oh, so the lesson that we learn from our Jupiter is that to create a big gassy planet, presumably anywhere in the universe, what you need to do is you start far from the sun, where it's cold, you form an ice ball, you grow. That's the theory.
It's a beautifully worked out theory. When I first started teaching classes, this is exactly what I taught because it describes the solar system perfectly. There's beautiful logic to it. It explains all the features that we see.
And then about 18 years ago, we discovered a planet that was not in our solar system.
The very first planet that was discovered around another star was bigger than Jupiter.
Okay.
Which is not surprising. It's easier to discover bigger things.
Right.
And it was closer to its star than Mercury is to the sun.
Now, is that close?
It's right up next to the star.
But wait, didn't you just say that a Jupiter-sized planet forms far from stars, out where it's cold? See, so
well, okay,
something's
so when you,
wrong.
When you find that first one,
yeah.
You just say, okay, that's weird. I don't know what happened.
But then they found
the second one found.
Yeah.
Bigger than Jupiter.
Uh-oh.
Right next to the star. Third one found. Bigger than Jupiter, right next to the star. It's crazy. It's probably two-thirds of them are this way.
At this point, we have seen more than 400 planets out there in space, most of them big and gassy, and overwhelmingly, they are not where they're supposed to be. Instead of being out in the cold like our Jupiter, scientists now figure they formed in the cold, and then very early on, they pushed through the dust and the other baby planets to move close to their stars. So many gassy planets formed and then moved next to stars that Mike Brown wonders.
Why didn't Jupiter?
Yeah. Why didn't our Jupiter do what all the other guys did? It's an important question, because if our Jupiter had moved in toward our sun, things would be very different today.
If you take Jupiter from where it is now and you were to move it inward, you will destroy anything that's inside there. There will be no Earth-like planets that are left after you moved Jupiter in.
So if our Jupiter had moved in?
We would have never been here.
Uh-oh. So what if it turns out that most solar systems in the universe have gassy planets that move in? Does that mean we're going to find fewer Earths or different Earths? What do we now think is normal out there?
We have no idea. Every planetary system that we get to see in detail appears different from anything that I would have expected.
Yeah, but still, there's got to be something you can predict. I mean, you do teach astronomy at Caltech, so
I've given up. I have no idea what to expect.
Haven't you told me that other astronomers were searching for solar systems like ours for, I don't know, like 5 years, 10 years, 12 years?
Something? 15 years, probably more than 15. It's probably been 20 years by now. But certainly 15.
And the method they've been using to search for planets is you have to wait for the possible planet to circle its star.
Yes.
So for a planet like Jupiter,
you would have to wait 12 years.
Okay. But since we've been looking for 12 or 15 or 20 years, it's right around now. If there are lots of solar systems like ours out there, we should start to see them. Or we should have seen them.
Or
we're about to should have seen them.
Or we should have seen a few. And when I look at the list of everything that's been discovered, there is one that maybe fits our picture.
That's a start.
It is a start. It was discovered a couple of years ago, and there's one.
One. And you're now looking for two.
Two would be good. A few more would be better.
I should say there are scientists, planet-hunting scientists, who think Mike's a little picky, and that actually there's several solar systems now that look kind of like ours, and they do expect to find more. Well, maybe, says Mike.
But we are at the stage now where we have had that time. We're starting to have enough time to have been able to see these things.
And now every month that goes by when we don't find solar systems like ours out there in the universe, we have to consider the possibility that what we call home may be a surprisingly uncommon place.
And now I'm wondering if it's going to the point where we're not uncommon, we are a rare exception.
Well, I think it's a little early to get that worried.
I'm not quite worried yet, but if things don't happen in the next year or so, I think it's time to get very worried.
Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars.
After all, Mike wants to think that what he has taught for years at school is still true, that solar systems like ours are ordinary and everywhere.
You want to be representative of the universe.
Like the other guys, I suppose.
Yeah.
And if it turns out that what we call home, our solar system, is a very rare thing, that's unsettling.
I think that's right. And I would like, deep down inside, I think I would like to see other things like the solar system out there, and it would make me feel at home.
Robert Krulwich, NPR News.
Speaking of other solar systems out there, if you go to our website, Robert has arranged a trip across the galaxy to see a solar system literally being born. That's at npr.org.
Our program is directed by Melissa Gray, edited by Corey Turner, and produced by Graham Smith. The technical director is Peter Elena. The engineering supervisor is Robert Jackson. Our planning editor is Jerry Holmes.
The staff includes Joel Riddle, Art Silverman, Brendan Banizak, Andrea Hsu, Gabe O'Connor, Carol Klinger, Chelsea Jones, Viet Le, and Rhonda Ray.
Our executive producer is Christopher Turpin. The managing editor for NPR News is David Sweeney. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
You may not be able to attack the side of a mountain like the snowboarder Shaun White, but you can at least attempt to look like the Olympic gold medalist. This fall, for $250, you'll be able to get a pair of the snowboard pants that he and the U.S. team wore at the Vancouver Olympics, the ones that you may have thought were ripped-up jeans.
While the pants look like something pulled out of last week's laundry basket, they're actually very high-tech. They were designed by Gregory Dakishin, who's the creative director at Burton Snowboards, and he joins us now from Burlington, Vermont. Now, these were based on a real pair of jeans, is that right?
They were based actually on a pair of my own denim, one of my favorite pairs, and through a process called photosublimation, we were actually able to print them onto a very sort of high-tech Gore-Tex fabric.
So wait, how does this work? You take a picture of the fabric?
You actually take a picture of an actual full pair of denim, almost like a giant photograph, and then through a process of extreme heat, you actually print a photograph directly onto a pair of pants.
And the pants are made out of some sort of waterproof Gore-Tex material?
It's a polyester fabric that we print on with a Gore-Tex laminate on the back. That's correct.
Did they actually have pockets and a fly?
They did, yep. Completely. I mean, very authentic to denim, except for the fact that it was two-layer, guaranteed to keep you dry, Gore-Tex technical fabric.
How long did it take?
I think we started the process almost 18 months ago. Coming into it, you know, it was a bit of a challenge. I wanted to do something that was really very American, but again, was very true to snowboarding and this idea of there's nothing more quintessential or iconic to American fashion is a great pair of jeans.
Why did Burton decide to manufacture more of these jeans and offer them to the public? It sounds like it's not a very easy process.
No, I mean, the sort of number of phone calls we received once the game started, I mean, I think for the most part people at first probably thought they were just wearing vintage denim, and then when they found out it was actual technical pant, I mean, I think they were very much intrigued and sort of, you know, the look of snowboarding right now is, you know, you always want something that I don't want to say, but your dad's not wearing. And this is sort of a look that very much doesn't look like it belongs on the hill. And I think it's something that's fresh. And we received hundreds of calls from consumers. And initially, we weren't planning on selling the pant. But being a rider-driven company, we really want to do things that our customers want us to do. And, you know, we decided to move forward with the pant and make it available to consumers.
And $250, that's the price point.
$250, that's right. And I think anyone that sort of gets them will be incredibly happy with not only the aesthetic of them, but the performance on them.
So what happened to that favored pair of jeans of yours that started this whole process?
They're still an essential part of my wardrobe. They're still in rotation, no doubt. Like I say, they tell a lot of stories. They're not going anywhere.
So you didn't have to cut them up or anything? You just took a picture?
No, I made very, very clear that that pair of jeans had to come back intact.
Well, Greg Dakishin, thank you very much for speaking to us.
Thank you very much.
Greg Dakishin is the creative director at Burton Snowboards. He was talking to us from Burlington, Vermont.